Hello and welcome to episode 429 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Ben Olson. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous, share news, and ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com, or send a voice recording of your question to help at thinkinglsat.com. Just record in a quiet place. Keep it to under 30 seconds, please. We've got a free class coming up Wednesday, November 22nd. That's the day before Thanksgiving. I'm going to be doing a version of my class available to everybody, no matter your subscription level, if you're a paid subscriber or just get a Demon free account and come do a 2-hour LSAT class with me. We'll do a little bit of everything. And that class is Wednesday, November 22nd, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. And you just need a Demon free account to join. Hope to see everybody there. Go to lsat.link/free if you'd like to sign up. Ben, we've got a registration deadline coming up. That's the registration for the January 2024 LSAT coming up on November 30th. Is that something that listeners, students should be thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing well in your practice tests, then you'd want to go ahead and sign up for the January LSAT. It's a shame, as we mentioned over and over and over on this podcast, that the registration deadline for the January LSAT is at the end of November. I mean, they really expect you to know well before the test that you're going to be ready for the test. And a lot of people don't know until they're closer to the actual exam. So kind of a bummer, but if you're not ready, don't sign up, because it's just going to tempt you to take a test that you probably shouldn't be taking.
Yeah. By the way, nobody should be intimidated by these registration deadlines. You should look at these as opportunities, and that's it, right? It's just, hey, here's a shot you can take if you want to take it. Are you ready to take that shot? Well, pretty simple math. Are your practice test scores equal to the score that's going to get you to the school you want to go to at the price you want to pay? Then you should probably take the shot. You've got five shots, you know, and law schools are only going to care about the highest one, the best of five attempts at the official test, or five in 5 years plus, right? It's a more complicated policy than that. But since you have so many opportunities to take it, you should be just kind of, are my scores where I want them to be? Great, let's do it. But if your scores are a mile away from where you want them to be, You can't like force yourself to be ready to take the shot, you know, and I think a lot of students get in their own way by trying to cram it in, or, you know, I'll motivate myself by registering for the test. Okay. So that you can now do like a crash 6-week LSAT prep program. That's not what we're really looking for. That's kind of bad. It hurts their own progress, right, when they prep that way. So I think you should just be prepping, right? Start prepping if you're serious about law school, you can, and your grades are in good shape, you can start prepping. Do practice tests, keep track of your results. And then when the scores start looking good, then you start thinking about registering. But yeah, if your scores aren't, let's say, you know, within 10 points for sure of where you need to be, then you just don't even need to worry about that registration. Start looking at the next one. We got an email here from Jason. The subject is rushing to take tests with logic games, ? Oh, appropriate to our discussion about whether to register or not register.
Sure. Hi, Ben and Nathan. I'm currently practice testing below my goal score of 175 plus, as I averaged 170 in the last 5 prep tests I've taken. However, logic games are my best section, and I'm currently signed up to take the February 2024 test, with the intention of taking April and June if necessary. Should I cram the January LSAT into my schedule as well, or should I relax and stick through the 3 chances I have with games in February, April, and June? I'm skeptical of my ability to get everything consistent enough by then, by January, but I also figured if I can afford to sign up and wing it, there's a chance I'll get lucky and end up with the score I want anyway. Well, this Jason, you're not like that far from your goal score of 175 plus. You averaged 170 in the last 5 prep tests you've taken. So presumably some of those are above 170, some of those are below 170. You still have a good month before the January LSAT. Yeah, if games is really your best section, it's your best. So it's better than logical reasoning and better than reading comprehension. Probably go for it.
I think yes, because Jason, I'm pretty sure Jason is scoring perfectly on the games.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to average 170 and have games be your best section. And
not be zero.
Yeah, not be minus zero if you're scoring 170, right? Because that means Jason's definitely missing questions on LR and RC, but yeah, I don't think so on games. So yeah, Jason, you've got 4 shots at it, right? January, February, April, June, and then the games are gone forever. Games is your best section. You're probably already perfect there. You have to get better at LR and RC anyway, but you've got time between now and January to work on those things. You've definitely got time between now and February, April, and June. So I would be looking at taking all of those if necessary. And you can't take all of them if necessary if you don't take this one. So yeah, I think you got to start shooting those shots. Perfect. Perfect segue. That's an example of somebody who, you know, you're not quite there, but you're also within striking distance. You've got good reason to. This is the one time where people maybe have a reason to kind of push the schedule a little bit.
Yeah, be a little bit more aggressive. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. One time only offer between now and, well, 4 times only offer between now and June of 2024. And then those games are gone.
Yep.
All right. Brennan wrote in with get practice scores up or roll the dice. Hi, Ben and Nathan. I'm a longtime listener, about 275 listened episodes. In the last couple of months, my practice test scores have ranged from 171 to 177. I took the September and October LSAT administrations and scored 171 and 173, respectively. I have postponed applying to law school until the next cycle. Should I schedule to take the next LSAT, or should I wait to register until my score, range, or average score rises? What do you think? I say keep taking it.
Yeah, I mean, you're very close. You've scored from 171 to 177.
There aren't very many scores above 177. I mean, I feel like if you have scored 177 ever on a timed official test, then you've got the green light from me to take the LSAT officially. I think people need more swagger a little bit, because that's not unjustified swagger. That's like totally justified swagger. And you're a home run hitter. You don't need to hit a home run on every single pitch. You don't need to hit a home run on every single at bat. You don't even need to hit a home run every single game. If you hit home runs every other game, that's good enough.
Get up to bat.
Keep swinging, dude. You're the best hitter out there. So keep swinging.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be good enough. It's a game where, again, you get five chances. So you've already taken September and October. That's 2 of your 5 chances. You've already scored in the 170s twice. You know that there are better scores that are within your range. You scored toward the low end of your range 2 times in a row. Well, that should happen 1 out of 4 times just from pure random chance. By the way, 173 is not, that's barely even the low half of your range. That's right in the middle of the range. So you're not even particularly unlucky. It looks to me like you've got a great range. The high scores that are within your range are really, really good. And seems clear that you should keep taking it and just be done with it. You agree?
Yeah. You know, Brennan has decided not to apply this cycle, but to wait until next cycle. So clearly taking our advice to take this process slowly. We're just saying, don't take it too slowly. You're ready. Go.
Yeah.
Don't hesitate.
We do see this a lot. Yeah, I appreciate that people are like taking our advice seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But some people take it to the extreme where it's like, I'm going to be the best thinking LSAT listener ever, and I'm going to do what they say times 100. Not really. If you've got scores that justify you taking it, then there's no need to be perfectionist about it.
I mean, they're doing what they think we're saying, but I think what we're trying to fight against, the vast majority of people listening are in the exact opposite camp, right? They want to go now.
Right.
They want to apply yesterday, and right. They need their score up 3 more points. Right. And you're like, stop. Just please, like, you are in the wrong game, playing it in the wrong way.
Yeah, well, that's why our tone becomes so cautionary all the time, where we're like, you don't need to rush this. You really should get your practice test scores up first. Don't waste your attempts. Don't, get your grades up first, or all those things that we always say. And then people want to take that really to the extreme. But you also can't, Brendan, don't give this test too much respect. You are good at the LSAT. You've scored excellent scores. 177, that's the 75th percentile at Yale, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't need better than that. And you're ready. And that'll, you got 3 more shots at it. I think you're a really good chance to get that number or higher, or a couple of points lower or whatever. But you're a good bet to beat the 173 that you have on record. And because you're a good bet to beat that 173, which is already a great score, you should just, fire 3 more bullets if necessary and see where you're at. But
one last thing to say here too, and this just echoes what we were saying to Jason, Brennan, if your games are your best section or doing, you're doing very well on them, which seems likely given your 171 to 177 practice test scores, right? Those games are going away. So let's also take advantage of this while they're here.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I guess Brennan has the chance to push it by 1 month, right? Because Brennan has 3 more attempts.
Yep.
So if you skip January, you could still do February, April, and June. But why? You're ready. I think sometimes delaying can actually like be a detriment because you are over respecting the official test.
Yeah, you're giving it too much. Like you're now, it's a different problem.
Yeah. And oh, by the way, what if you get sick on one of these official test dates?
Yeah.
Or there's a funeral, or there's world events, or there's weather, power outages, bad things can happen on those official test days. So being able to take 3 out of the next 4 instead of skipping 1 on purpose and then doing 3 out of 3 with the games, that doesn't make any sense either.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Next one is from Kyle. Subject is study plan.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. LSAT Demon subscriber here. I've been with the Demon since August and started with a 147 diagnostic test score. I just took my first LSAT in November and felt that I did not perform to the best of my abilities. Practice test scores have been in the low 160s recently. I plan to take the test again. So wait, we don't know what score this person got. But anyways, I plan to take the test again in January and want to get a 165 plus. What is your best advice on how to study from now until then? Typically, my section scores look like this. Logic games, -0 to -4. Logical reasoning, -4 to -8. And reading comprehension, -8 to -12. Don't shriek. Okay, we won't. I thoroughly enjoy the demon. Thanks, Kyle. Well, you definitely don't want to trade your games for another logical reasoning section. So
you've been in the low 160s recently and you want to get a 165 or higher. Games is your best section. You're a pretty good bet to do, games are pretty... reliable. Like once you get good at the games, you can feel pretty damn confident that you're going to score. You know, it seems like Kyle knows that he's going to get at least three games and sometimes all four perfect.
Hmm.
And he's quite opposite in reading comp, right? Like reading comp, Kyle's getting two passages or sometimes three, or who knows, because it could be all four passages with terrible accuracy. It's probably three passages, right?
Probably.
With not perfect accuracy is what that looks like to me. But Kyle seems clear about taking these tests. Kyle's going to just took the first one in November. That might have been premature, though. I mean, that's the thing, is that it's like 147 diagnostic. Do you want to settle for a score of 165? Ben, what do you think?
Okay, so if Kyle gets a 167, that's a 20-point increase. Certainly a great increase, but also, you know, it's very common for people scoring 147 to get into the high 160s, let alone the low 170s. But high 160s, it's kind of like Kyle is recognizes that maybe, but is shooting for a slightly safer option. Like you might want to expect more from yourself. You also might want to spend or start thinking about reading comp a little bit more like games. It's a section that you can dramatically improve on if you start focusing on the underlying skills and steps that you need to take to understand the passage.
Specifically, must be true questions on the games, right? You know, they're asking you, hey, what did it say? What has to be true here based on these rules, or based on, you know, this setup and these rules, and which one has to be true? The reading comp, they're asking you what has to be true based on the passage. What did it say in the passage? Which one can you get? You know, like, yep, there was a rule about that. There was a comment about that.
There's basically 16 rules in the passage. What were those 16 rules? Did you catch them?
Yeah. We have Eric, podcast producer Eric, teaches classes for us at LSAT Demon. He has a cross-training class. We've mentioned it before on the show. He periodically does a class where he talks about taking your strength in logic games and translating it to success in reading comprehension specifically. So if you're a live subscriber, you could go back and look at the recorded versions or do the recorded versions of those classes or schedule for an upcoming one. Sounds like, you know, the argument for Kyle taking a shot is you've got four chances at the games. Games is your best section. You should be taking it. You should be taking these four attempts, and then your LSAT career is going to be over forever. Hopefully you can get minus zero on the games. If you are missing questions on the games, then you do need to keep practicing the games, because like we want those points. Your score relies on those points. How to study logical reasoning and reading comprehension? You know, it's always the same there. It's look at your mistakes, thoroughly review your mistakes, understand why you made that mistake. And it's two mistakes per question. Why did you pick the wrong answer? And also, why didn't you pick the right answer? And you've got to be able to thoroughly, you know, like imagine, could you explain it to Nathan? Could you explain it to me to my satisfaction? What that you really get why the right answer is right, and also why that wrong answer is wrong, and like convince me that you understand why it's wrong. Do this in your head. And then I'm probably also going to ask you questions like, well, why did you make those mistakes? Those are the questions. That's the soul searching that you can do to go, okay, so what was it that I was really doing when I failed to pick that right answer? And also separately, what was it that I was doing when I picked that wrong answer? What was I doing? How did I make that mistake? But that applies to all students on day one and day 101 of your LSAT prep. What do you think? Anything more for Kyle?
The only other thing I was going to say is that you made an argument for why or you said the argument for why Kyle should take it now is that he's got these four exams left with the games, right?
And it's a short argument. Yeah. It's like, well, okay, because this is a limited time offer and because they allow you to take five cracks at it in 5 years, and because Kyle has four remaining with four remaining tests that do include Kyle's best section, it's like, well, okay, unless you're going to like turn reading comp into your best section or turn logical reasoning into, sorry, not reading comp. If you were going to turn logical reasoning into your best section and get to the point where you're getting minus zero, you know, then I could see why you would want to just wait and say, nah, forget the games. But because games is Kyle's best section, and you know, there is that case to be made that he should push to take these tests.
Yeah. And I agree. And I think that that's probably the best option for Kyle, especially given his goal of 165 plus. But there is this other side, which I think is less clear than it was for Jason or Brennan. And that is, look, Kyle, if you're willing to entertain a higher goal, it depends on how much progress you can make in reading comp in the next couple of months. Can you really start to close that gap? Can you start
and
to
LR.
Close the gap? And yep. LR. If you can, don't throw away the idea that maybe you end up taking more time, that you withdraw from the test that you've signed up for to keep that option open, to then shoot for something higher. But you're going to have to see what you can do in LR and reading comp in the next couple months.
Yeah. Our plan would be, here's how Kyle gets his 165. For sure. Keep taking the test now. If Kyle's goal was 175, then it would be instantly opposite advice, because don't take the test now. Right now, you have no chance of scoring 175. So you would then have to delay until you improve LR and reading comp.
Yep. This next one, Abigail shared this ask button question. The question says, aren't assumptions unstated by definition?
Nope.
This sentence seems like a fact premise, not an assumption. That's why I eliminated it. Did the definition of assumption change all of a sudden?
Well, Abigail points to the Cambridge Dictionary's definition of assumption. So they say that an assumption is something that you accept as true without question or proof.
Okay. It would help to have a little more context here, but I think what's happening is that the student has read an answer choice that they thought was said in the passage. It turns out to be an assumption that was made by the passage. They eliminated it because it was actually said in the passage, and they're saying, hey, it's not an assumption. It was said. And then they're like, wait, so then does this change the meaning of assumption? Now, we can get into that discussion, but I'm going to tell you, almost all the time that this happens, the sentence wasn't actually said in the passage.
You think it was said.
You think it was said, but when you go back, really, it's like, where does it say that? And you're like, that sentence doesn't say that. That other sentence doesn't say that. That's the assumption that's being made. I get it, that it's like, it feels like it was said, and therefore that's why it's correct. It's a necessary assumption. So I'd be curious if this was actually said. We got to start there, and then we can start questioning whether an assumption is something that could be, quote, said. But I bet it wasn't.
Consider an example.
Mm-hmm.
If I say, if you're in Modesto, you are in California. If you're in California, you are in the United States. It seems like I said, if you're in Modesto, then you're in the United States. But I didn't really say it. I didn't actually do the logic. I just stated a premise, and then I stated another premise. And those two things do necessarily imply a thing.
Yeah.
But I didn't say it out loud. That's just an example. It's like, you actually would want to put that step into your legal writing. You actually have to make that explicit conclusion. Anyway, I'm just trying to illustrate that it can sound like they said it when they did not, in fact, actually say it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To your point. Yeah. I would want to say, well, sorry, did you want to follow? Did you want to go say more?
No,
about
I
that?
just, I don't know if I've actually ever seen, like, maybe once, but even then I'm not so sure if that's actually true.
Yeah.
I don't think I've actually seen an answer where it's like, oh yeah, that was said. Huh. So maybe an assumption in their minds also includes things that were explicitly said. I don't think I've ever come across it. When push comes to shove, it's like, no, yeah, that wasn't said. So
yeah.
You're misreading the answer. This happens a lot with longer answers. Because you start unpacking what was literally said and you're like, no, that wasn't said. So, you know, okay. We can get into the debate of whether something that was explicitly said can also be considered an assumption, but I don't think it happens.
Okay. I would further just say that it's not going to be useful to think about when you're trying to solve assumption questions on the LSAT. Whether it's true or not true, you know, it doesn't say unstated in that Cambridge definition that Abigail has provided us. It says something you accept as true without question or proof. I think that if you want to just be practical about it, right, just be totally pragmatic, let go of the semantic issue of whether it is or is not violating this rule, and just take it from me that it's not going to help you answer the question. So when you get to a necessary assumption question, if they're asking you for an assumption that's required by the argument, just turn it into a must be true question. Which one of the following must be true according to this author? And if it sounds like they already said it, that's the answer. That's something that must be true according to them. Yeah. So just don't worry about it. Don't worry about whether stated or unstated. It's not going to help you on the LSAT. So just forget about it is the real practical advice.
I would add, actually, as you're saying that, if you do have this odd belief that what was said is wrong because it was already said, the practical implication of that is go back and reread the answer. Like, get better at reading these answers, right? Like, there's a lesson there probably, because if you're saying, oh, but this was explicitly already said, and that hardly ever happens, then we also need to work on your reading skills.
Oh, because if you're wrong about that, then that it's a reading issue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. You're reading something. You're saying, oh, that was already said and it wasn't. So let's get a better handle on what explicitly was said in that answer.
Cool. Madeline writes in and about applying in January, if you will probably take the test again. Should you apply in January, even if you're probably going to take the test again, is going to be the question.
Yeah, I can pretty much say the answer is going to be no to that.
But my hypothesis is also no, but let's see the specifics.
I'm taking the LSAT for the first time in January and was planning on using that score to apply for law schools as a late applicant for fall 2024. However, I've accepted that I should and probably will take the LSAT once or twice more and apply for the fall 2025 cycle.
Great.
Okay, so this is someone who's in that transition from, okay, here was my plan, and maybe that's not the best plan. Takes time to accept that sometimes. Should I even apply in January? If my score is, say, a 167, should I apply to see my scholarship offers? Will it look bad if I decline and reapply in September for fall of 2025? Any thoughts or opinions are greatly appreciated. Many thanks, Madeline. Yeah, this is an easy one to answer.
Short answer, no. I appreciate where Madeline's head is at, though. I like it. I like the thought behind it, because I don't think Madeline is saying, should I apply anyway just to see if I actually do get a good offer? I think what Madeline is saying is, should I apply right now just for like intel? You know, just to see. Hey, just fish around, see what the offers are, but not, you know, plan on now. I'm really starting in 2025, but I'll apply now. See those offers. Keep retaking, apply again.
I do wonder though. I mean, that could be her mindset, but I do wonder if she's also part of her's like, let me see if I get some good offers.
And that's why you really don't do it, is because even if only 1% of your brain is like, well, but you know, you could, who knows? And then and then some school gives you just attractive enough, you know?
Yeah.
It's an 82% scholarship.
You're like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen next application cycle. I can secure this offer right here and now. It's that desire for certainty over the uncertain, right? But what we're telling you is we're certain you're going to do better.
Yeah, it's just, you know that you can score better. You haven't even taken the official LSAT yet. You know, taking your first LSAT in January is wildly late for fall of 2024 admissions. I think that that is just insane. If it were your fifth LSAT, then maybe it would be a different story. But when it's your first LSAT, you are going to be settling for less than your best official score. You can't expect that you're going to get your best official score on your very first attempt. That's not the right way to think about this test. You have a range of scores. The official score is going to be a score within that range of scores. You need to plan on taking the LSAT multiple times. Otherwise, you're going to get less than your best. Do you want one shot at it, or do you want five shots at it? And so, you know, sounds like Madeline wants to follow our advice. Don't worry about, no, do not do these January applications. Plan on taking it not just once or twice more. Don't take it in January unless you're happy with your practice test scores. If you are happy with your practice test scores, then you should be thinking about taking it in January, February, June, August, or sorry, January, February, April, June, and August, if necessary, to position yourself for applying at the beginning of the next cycle. It's not once or twice more. That's, you're putting too much pressure on every official attempt. You know, hopefully you only have to take it once or twice, but you've got to also plan for all of those retakes just in case. You've got the luxury, Madeline has the luxury of some time, but you should be thinking through, like, if it goes well, then great, maybe I'm done. But if it doesn't go as good as it could, I've got to be thinking about taking it again. Okay, anything more for Madeline?
Yeah, I would just for anybody, I mean, it's odd because, like, January is not late for 2025, but it could be late. Like, you're going to try to fit in five tests before September?
Right. I would say that that's, like, pretty much in the middle of the range of, like, okay, cool. Like, I would look at Madeline and I would go, excellent. You're already studying now. You're planning on a first attempt in January. That gives you February, April, June, August, four potential backup dates. The last one, August, is a different test. It won't have games. It'll have double logical reasoning. The scores will come out after applications have opened for 2025, which is okay. I'm not worried about that because it's your fifth attempt. I don't really care.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that Madeline is kind of like dead on perfect for the 2025 cycle. If it were a month later, you know, if your first test was February, then I'd be thinking, okay, so February, April, June, August, and then we don't even know what your fifth attempt will be because LSAC hasn't released those tests yet.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, okay, yeah, like, let's for sure get moving. I would tell Madeline, let's get moving.
It's just funny to be even thinking about 2024, right? That's my point. Anyways.
It's very, very late for 2024.
Like, you're barely, like, not barely, but you're on time, but just on time. You're not early for 2025. You're on time for 2025. So to think about 2024, you're really like a year. You're almost exactly a year late.
Right. Totally. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Dylan has an application decision forthcoming.
Hello, Ben and Nathan. Nathan, recently my application for Fordham University was put on hold. The email they sent me said that they could not decide on me yet, so I have to wait until mid-February for their decision. I'm a splitter, which is probably why they did not want to admit me yet. Does this mean that applying early was pointless because they wait for better applicants later in the cycle anyway? Are my chances of getting in slim? Is this another way of saying I'm waitlisted? Should I do anything to show the school I'm serious about attending? Thank you for everything that you guys do. You know, Dylan, I don't know what other schools you apply to, but the thing that's just, like, banging around in my head right now is schools are going to deny you that you thought you were going to get into, maybe even with a full ride. Schools are going to waitlist you. All this shit is going to happen but we don't care about any of it because we apply broadly and just say, okay, fine, to schools that are not interested. Like, we want schools that are knocking on your door and saying, please come to our university. We will give you money to be here. And they're not doing any of this stuff to string you along. So it sounds to me like you didn't apply to enough schools or with a high enough score, and now you're beholden to this school. And
yeah,
it's not a conversation that we would normally have. We just say, fine, we're going to turn to the next contestant because we've applied broadly.
Yeah. They're not excited about you going to their law school. They're, you know, if they were excited about it, they would have been offering you a scholarship. I'm going to go to lsatdbin.com/scholarships because I want to look at Fordham's 509 report. And there's a little link there to Fordham's 509. Scrolling down to the third page of the top of the third page of their 509 report, you know, 83% of the people who attend Fordham get some sort of grant. So they're giving discounts to 83%. They don't give very many full tuition discounts, but they give 29% of their class gets a half to full tuition discount. That's kind of interesting that Dylan thinks that they might be waiting for better applicants later in the cycle. That's not what they're doing at all. What they're doing is they're offering scholarships to attractive candidates, waiting to see who of those attractive candidates accept their scholarships, waiting to, you know, and they've also admitted people who probably have better numbers than you do, Dylan. They have admitted those, you know, better combination of LSAT and GPA. You're a splitter, so your grades, I guess, suck, and, you know, your LSAT is trying to do a lot of work there. And point is, it sounds like they're doing admissions decisions in rounds, or maybe they've even looked. Yeah. Maybe you are on a wait list or a wait list with they're going to tell you a decision by a certain date or something. That's interesting. Interesting. But the point is, they're not offering you a scholarship. And because they're not offering you a scholarship, I would be looking to go to law school elsewhere. If they give 83% of their students some sort of a scholarship, like, you want to be on a scholarship there, or you just probably don't want to be going to that school. I don't know. Ben?
I'm concerned that Dylan didn't apply broadly enough, because if you were Dylan, yep, you wouldn't be so worried about Fordham. You'd just be saying, fine, I got, yep, a full ride here, or I got a more than half tuition scholarship there. So I'm talking to those schools. Yeah, I'm wondering if you're going to have to reapply next cycle to more schools or get a better LSAT, right, score. We don't know anything about your GPA. We don't know anything about your LSAT score. So it's really hard to kind of say more.
Yeah, you know, it could be that, like, that you live, in, you know, Fordham is in your neighborhood, and you really wanted to walk to school at Fordham, but there's a lot of different law schools in New York City, and there's other law schools around New England and the entire East Coast. And there's other places that you could be. You need to get them bidding on you instead of, yeah, putting all of your eggs in that one basket. Okay. Nolan writes in, it says, to Loki or not to Loki, LOCI. That's a letter of continuing interest, I guess. Continued interest. A follow-up that you might send to law schools that you have applied to. 3.92 GPA, 165 LSAT. Nolan is a pretty solid candidate for law school.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not Harvard, Stanford, Yale.
Doesn't seem like it with that 165.
Yeah, the 3.92 might even be low for those schools, but the 165 for sure is low for those schools. Full ride candidate, though, at many, many law schools.
For sure. Yep.
For sure. With a 3.92 and a 165, if you apply broadly, you're going to get multiple full ride offers. While optimistic about my prospects, says Nolan, I recognize that my ultimate goal, UT Law, has a significantly higher LSAT median than I achieved. Yeah. As I'm not URM and a Texas resident who attended Texas A&M, I anticipate a challenging path and a potential waitlist situation. I seek your advice on drafting letters of continued interest. Are they truly effective, or could they be a potential waste of time? Moreover, what elements make an impactful letter of continued interest that could persuade admissions officers? During my studies, I avidly listened to and loved your podcast, and I would greatly appreciate your sagacious advice on the matter. Thanks.
I'm assuming that comes from the word sage.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be looking it up right now.
Okay.
But what's your advice?
Okay. So let's step back for a half second. One, I do think letters of continued interest are not a waste of time, because when you think about the time it's going to take you to write it compared to the potential benefit of them re-looking at your application, understanding that you're still interested, like, I don't think your time is that exponentially valuable. So no, I don't think it's a waste of time. Does that mean, though, that the benefit that's going to accrue from that is significant? No, it's not. I mean, the things that matter, as we've said over and over and over again, are numbers, your LSAT score and your GPA. Does a letter of continued interest change those numbers? No. So it's like everything else that we talk about, you know, softs and things like that.
Can I just, the fact that there's an acronym for this, what? It's a fucking social pleasantry.
It is. Yeah, it's high.
It's a note. It's a quick email.
Yep, exactly.
You really think that that's going to be, you have to like craft a persuasive, no, it's a quick courtesy. Nothing more. Those quick courtesies can add up a lot if you're just kind of but you know, just be a genuine, personable human, you know, like if there are opportunities for you to have a real relationship with somebody at that school and you care, then do, you know, like you care about Texas A&M, right? So if there's somebody in that office that you can get to know, then that would be fantastic if you could get to know them. But as far as like this, you know, it seems like you've learned this online, right? You were on Reddit or whatever, and you saw people throwing this acronym around, and you started thinking that they're like, it's an element of your application or something.
Yeah.
But it's a quick note that says, excellent, I can't wait to hear from you. Or, you know, it's a response to something that they've said, or it's a
reaching out. Yeah.
I'm just reaching out. I applied 6 weeks ago or two months ago or whatever it is, or I retook the LSAT and I have this higher score now that I wanted to make sure you guys were aware of, or I got promoted at my job, so I wondered how I update my application. But the fact that we're going to call that a low-key, L-O-C-I, and make a big
letter,
like,
of
it's
continued,
a whole thing. Like, yeah. I'm going to get out my quill pen and my parchment paper and my wax seal and all that. It's like, no, it's a quick email. And it's not like this, you don't have to be doing it in like this mercenary sort of a way. It can just be, you're presumably genuinely interested in their school and they work at the school and you forge this like connection with them.
This thought came to me earlier in the podcast. I didn't mention it, but you were talking about respect, right? I think it was the second person who wrote in. Maybe it was Jason. The first person, or no, it was Brennan, giving too much respect to the LSAT and therefore pushing it off, right? And I feel like this same thing is happening here, where people are giving too much respect to the schools and the application process. Like, it's like you're sweating for hours over this email or letter that you're going to send off. Stop giving that. If you're giving the school that much respect, you've already lost the negotiation. Like, you need to put yourself in a more powerful position by applying broadly and not disrespecting them, I'm not saying you're going to fire off a meme like, hey, yo, I haven't heard from you. If you're not going to respond, I'm not going to respond to you. Like, we don't need to like go in the opposite direction.
Yeah, you email them and it's like, yeah. Did you, with it just you, did you look at my application yet?
Yeah.
No question mark.
I have three other offers I need to get back to immediately, you know. Yeah, like you don't need to be that guy, but at the same time, you also don't need to be sweating about this.
You don't need to like hire somebody to help you craft your letter of continued
interest. You're Loki.
Yeah, you're Loki. Nah. Sagacious means having or showing keen mental discernment and good judgment.
Thanks, Nolan.
It's an adjective. I think that you could have just said sage there as well. Can't you use sage just as an adjective?
Sage,
yeah, sage advice.
Yep.
I trust, Nolan, as a former avid listener of the show during your studies, I trust that that means that you did exhaust all of your official LSAT attempts. 165 is the best that you can do, right? Because that's what's holding you back. Like this, the Loki matters zero compared to that LSAT. And if that LSAT could be 166 or 167 or 168, if you're leaving even a few points on the table, then you're just doing the wrong thing if you're serious about University of Texas law.
Yeah.
And I know Nolan knows that because Nolan did it our way, right? So Nolan used all five of his attempts in 5 years, and 165 is his highest possible score.
Yep.
Okay. Alex says, should I retake? Alex has an official 162 and 175 on record.
I was hoping.
Short answer? Probably not.
Yeah, good job on the 175.
Good job. Yeah. Okay, go.
I was helping a friend of mine study and did the most recently released practice test and got a 180. This has led me to consider retaking the LSAT. The average of my last 30 practice tests is 174.6. Do you guys think a rewrite is worth it? For context, I'm only applying in Canada and I have a 3.5 GPA. Thanks, guys. Eric writes, did a little fact checking for us. He said, I checked the admissions websites for all 18 English speaking Canadian law schools. As far as I can tell, McGill is the only one that averages LSAT scores. Almost all explicitly state that they take the highest score. That's interesting. That's news to me. I thought it was more broadly a pattern in Canada to average.
Sounds like
LSAT
it's not
scores.
Even a thing at all. Sounds like it's just a thing at McGill. So if you're applying to McGill, then I guess there would be reason to retake it to like prove your higher score. It's like a stupid policy. It's so dumb of them because once you learn how to do the LSAT, I mean, Alex could just grind it out. It wouldn't be hard at all to improve Alex's average LSAT. It's like all they're really doing is penalizing you for taking it before you were really ready.
Yeah, you're talking about McGill's policy.
McGill's dumb policy of averaging. Yeah, and it's obviously dumb because 17 out of 18 other Canadian schools aren't doing it, and none of the schools in the United States are doing it. So what are you doing? I mean, it's clearly a bad policy. I mean, unless you want to reward people like Alex you want to penalize them because they took it before they were really ready, or you want to penalize them for having a bad day. I don't know why you would do that. Or you want to reward them for, like, it's a test that they've mastered, and now you think that it's good that they go take it again and again and again just to raise their average. I mean, I guess it's a sign of commitment, but I don't know. I don't think they're thinking through their policy.
Yeah. So, Alex, I would take it again, because either it's going to raise your average, which right now is extraordinarily lower than a 175, and you're going to get something higher than that. you're going to get higher than that average. So your average is going to raise for McGill, if that's the one school that matters to you. And if you take it again and do better than 175, well, everywhere else is going to reward that immediately. So I don't see any downside to retaking it.
There's no downside, but there's also just not a lot of upside. You've got a 175 on record. 175 is going to be higher than the high end of almost every school already anyway. Like a few points better, like that would matter for Yale, but I don't think it matters for like almost anybody else. And
it does matter for McGill though, right? Like even right, if he gets a lower than 175 is, yeah.
Correct. But I don't even know that Alex is applying to McGill.
That's true. We don't know.
I mean, applying in Canada, McGill happens to be in Canada. But again, Eric says that there are 17 out of 18 law schools in Canada, most of them explicitly saying we only care about your highest score.
Yeah.
So I don't think those schools care. If Alex, if you're not applying to McGill, then there's just, yeah, the upside is, you know, it seems like you're a 50-50 bet to score higher than 175 on a retake. So sure, retake it, get a couple points higher. But I don't think it's going to really matter very much at most schools. If you especially were telling me that you wanted Canada. To go to, sorry?
Yeah. Especially in Canada, right? What are the 175 for those schools? Is that, where does that fall for their
I'm not
applicants?
Sure they even publish their LSAT stuff. I mean, it's, you know, Canada's different. There is no, it's not the American Bar Association with the 509 reports and stuff. But I think we're pretty safe to assume that 175 is going to be like the 75th percentile everywhere.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm not really seeing the upside except potentially at McGill, because you will be able to raise your average for McGill.
Yep.
That's it. That's that. Anonymous writes in. Anonymous is asking what to consider when picking a law school with JAG in mind. Again, that's Judge Advocate General, military lawyer.
Yep.
As a veteran, scholarships generally matter less because of financing options available to veterans. Financing? You mean grants, right? I aim to join the JAG Corps, so law school ranking and prestige are also less critical. Huh, really? Okay, that's surprising to me. Maybe JAG Corps is more like, you know.
Did you do it?
Well, what I was going to say is maybe it's more, it's just not like, you know, it's not going to always be Tom Cruise. It's like JAG Corps is more like, well, you've got your district attorney's office, you've got your public defender's office, you've got your, like, it's just a government functionary, right?
Yeah.
Rather than, and probably that's what it is, right? It's like the entire military law system. Not just the top. Although, again, I might guess that if you really wanted to be a all-star in the JAG Corps, you still might need to go to Yale or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Primarily, the JAG Corps only requires applicants to be an attorney who passed the bar and otherwise be eligible for military service, mentally, physically, etc. While the process is still competitive, JAG applicants are evaluated with weight given to UGPA, law school GPA, extracurriculars, letters of recommendation, and interviews, as opposed to law school rank or prestige.
Well, if that's true, then law school GPA is one of those factors. Getting into a law school that you're going to be a killer at would help.
Oh, yeah. So you should still, ironically, probably just go take a scholarship. Because that's going to be a real good, like,
indicator, yeah, that you're going to be great at that school and have thus a good GPA.
Yeah, want to beat the curve at a school? Well, one way to just kind of self-select for that is to get a scholarship. If they've offered you a scholarship, like a full ride, they're not offering everybody a full ride. They're offering their best candidates a full ride. So if you do take that full ride, even if it doesn't matter because the military is going to pay anyway, which you never know. You might be able to get some like cash out benefits if you arrange things the right way. As I wrap up my LSAT journey, what other factors should I consider in evaluating law schools if the money and prestige don't matter as much for my situation? Do I focus on the best quality of life factors? Thanks in advance, Anonymous.
You know, the irony here is that when we tell people to go to law school for free, the pushback is always, well, okay, to do that, I have to go to a school that's slightly lower ranked than the one I wanted to go to. I got into a school ranked 10th, but to go for a full ride, I'm going to have to go to a school ranked 18th. So I'm giving up that rank and prestige to go to a school that's going to basically let me go there for free. And we always say, yeah, don't worry about that. You're giving up that rank and prestige, which really isn't as big as you think it is. And in exchange, you now get to be at the top of your class, which is going to increase your chances of at OCI and all these other benefits, right? So when Anonymous comes here and says, hey, look, I don't care about ranking and prestige, the case becomes even stronger to go to a school that's going to accept you with a scholarship. Because that's the only thing you're giving up when you take a full ride scholarship. We don't think you're giving up that much. We don't think it's worth the, we think it's better to give that up and get what you're going to get in return. But if you don't care about that, well, then there is nothing holding you back from going to the best school that's going to pay for you full ride.
But they do care. The JAG application does care about your rank relative within your class.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you can ignore the law school rankings entirely and just go to a school where you're really going to thrive, which is what we've been saying. You know, go be a big fish in a small pond somewhere. And if you apply broadly, the schools that are offering you full rides are likely to be the places where you're going to be that big fish in a small pond, which is going to put you in great position for JAG, it sounds like, which is your ultimate destination. I love this plan. I do think that Anonymous has the luxury of deciding on quality of life factors. I mean, I think you should be thinking about, I think you should be thinking about where you want to maybe live long term, but I guess JAG might change that a little bit because JAG might just be telling you where you're going to live.
Sure. But for the 3 years, you definitely could, right? Apply broadly, apply to schools that are right in, like, you know, that range that's going to give you full tuition scholarships, get a bunch of those, pick the one that's most interesting to you.
The other thing is if it really is like full financing from Uncle Sam, if Uncle Sam is going to be paying not just tuition, but also living expenses, then you might actually think about like, you would purposely go live somewhere because they're going to pay you relative living expenses. Yeah. Uncle Sam's just going to pay your relative living expenses. And so, like, you know, if you go and live in New York City, if you decide to go to law school in New York City, they're going to like pay New York City rent. Hmm. And in some of these programs. So that could be, you know, when he says quality or he or she says quality of life factors, they absolutely might mean or they might be like kind of agnostic to how much it actually costs to live in a place.
Yeah.
And in that case, I would say go to the places that it's the most expensive because for me, like those places are the most expensive because they're the best places. What else do you think? Is there anything else that Anonymous should be thinking about when evaluating law schools?
No, I just love how this all lines up. I mean, scholarship is a proxy for success at the school you're going to go to. And everyone should be trying to succeed at the school they go to.
Proxy. Yeah. I mean, it's not like 100%. It's not like guaranteed. Not there's no guarantees of anything.
Yeah.
But if they're giving you a scholarship and they're not giving these other people a scholarship, then that's probably because you have better grades, better LSAT, better application. You're going to be positioned well probably to compete against those people. It's an easy way to maybe limit your choices because you probably have like too many choices. You could go anywhere, it seems.
Good.
Cool.
All right.
Word of the week.
This
is a new feature suggested by Ben.
Yeah. The other day, 2 days ago, maybe I was reading a New York Times article and the sentence said, Prince Harry plumbed his royal life in spare. Now, I have no interest in Prince Harry or his book, but I had never seen the word plumbed or used in this way. So I had to look it up. and it means to examine minutely and critically. So apparently Prince Harry examined minutely and critically his royal life in the book Spare, and that's the word plumbed. Anyways, had to look it up, thought I would share it here.
The reason why you want to share this is because you're trying to illustrate to our listeners that we do practice what we preach. One of the things that we preach to our students and to our listeners is that lawyers are going to be gladiators of the English language.
Yeah.
You know, instead of word of the week, we could call this a gladiator corner. I don't know.
Gladiator training. Yeah.
Training camp, boot camp. Anyway. Yeah. It's looking up words is critical.
Yep.
To increasing your understanding of, yeah, these powerful tools that you will use every day of your career as a lawyer. And it's so interesting and it's so fun. I find myself doing it all the time.
Yeah, every other day at least. I'm probably looking up a word for clarification.
I'd say more than that. Yeah. I think every day. I already looked up a word while we were doing this podcast.
Once
you start doing it, and by the way, it's just a right click away in most web browsers. It's super easy to do it. Plumbed is a cool word. It makes me think of, you know, like, okay, how does your reading pay off? Plumbed. I would have heard that in, like, you know, the context of, I think people say plumbed the depths a lot.
Yeah.
Or I think it's like probably a sailing thing, like a nautical thing that I think to plumb is to like lower a weight, you know, on like a measuring rope and you can drop it to your, you know, maybe it's your
anchor.
You're
exploring the depths.
Plumbing the depths, exploring the depths. Yeah. Seeing how, I think when you do that with the weight, you know, and sink it to the bottom, you're just like, okay, how deep is it here? You want to know how deep it is. Mm-hmm. So you plumb the depths. So, okay. So then in context, if Prince Harry is, he's leaning over the rail, lowering this thing down into, he's plumbing his royal life. So he's looking at it. Obviously that's what he's doing in a book that he's writing. What else is he writing about?
Yeah.
Cool. I guess I'll throw in there too. I mean, a word that I looked up this week and I remembered what looking it up and thinking like, oh yeah, okay. That's like another thing that it just to share on the show. Potentially I looked up the word avarice. I was playing board games over the weekend with my friends, Mike and Nikki down in LA. We were playing Frosthaven for like the entire weekend straight. And my character just has turned out to be extremely greedy. My guy, like, he's good at looting. And so all he does is like goes around and gets loot. And I had used the word avarice to describe my guy. I think I was apologizing to Mike and Nikki for the avarice of my character. And then I thought, that sounds kind of douchey. Why did I say avarice? Couldn't I just have said greed? Like, am I trying to use a 10-cent word where a 5-cent word will do?
Yeah.
And I felt obnoxious. So then I looked it up, and just to be sure that I was using it correctly, I was. Avarice means extreme greed.
Extreme greed. Yeah.
So maybe it's actually a good word, because it's like, well, it's not just greed. It's like very much greed. And I don't know.
It's funny you share that word too, because that's a word. That's a perfect example. So for me, plumbed, in my sense, I don't know my actual experience, but my sense was when I saw that word, no experience with it whatsoever. It was like a blank slate, right? When you said avarice, it's like, I have this negative association with it. So I clearly have been exposed to it. But if you asked me to define it, clearly I would be stumbling around to like one of the words that came to my mind was malice, which isn't quite accurate. But like I had this negative association with it, right? And I think a lot of words fall into these categories. One, you clearly know what it means and you know its definition and you know its multiple definitions. Then there are words where you only know one of the maybe two or three actual definitions. And then there are words like avarice for me where it's like I have a feeling, I have an association with it, but it's not clear. And then for me, the word plumbed, I had no association with it whatsoever. I just read it and was like, what? I mean, I could guess based on context, but it's like, I don't have any emotional attachment to that word in any sense. And we're all these words fall on the spectrum or on this spectrum. And the goal is to try to push more and more words over into the clear territory so that you can really understand what other people are trying to say.
Sharpen your swords, I guess, is what exactly. We're saying.
Yep.
You know, and yeah. it's a never ending process. You're doing this every day for the rest of your life. That's the game you're getting yourself into.
Yep.
I think it's fun. I think it's interesting. So we'll do more gladiator corner / word of the week on future episodes. You can be LSAT famous. Please ask us questions or share news with us at Thinking LSAT. If you have questions about the LSAT demon, you can email the best customer service team in the world. That's help@lsatdemon.com. Please check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 429 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.